Hello and welcome to this week's Alpha Podcast. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
Yeah, I'm well, thanks.
Excellent. So I had a flick through your Alpha report this week. You mentioned that markets are very gloomy and you don't really want to talk about them again, so we won't. I think that makes a lot of sense. We're going to focus on companies again today. And I think the companies we might want to focus on this week are sort of big old chuggers, as I think you've called them in the past. Unilever, Reckitt Benckiser. And we're going to talk about something that's a little bit more than a chugger, Games Workshop, which you've written about in your magazine column. Let's start with Unilever, who had Q3s out this week, as did Reckitt Benckiser. Both of them were pretty good. What do you think of them?
I thought Reckitt's was a lot better than Unilever. Primarily, I think, because I think Reckitt's is better set up to exploit the sort of trends that we're seeing with coronavirus, people washing their hands more. And, you know, they've got two very, very good disinfectant brands in Dettol and Lysol. And also products that people tend to use a bit more when they're at home, such as dishwasher tablets and air fresheners. And I thought the results from Reckitt's were superb, actually.
Yeah, they upped their guidance as well, so they expect this to continue for a while.
Yeah, Reckitt's is a company that, and Unilever, they're both two companies that I've been quite lukewarm on for quite some time.
But you do have them both in the fantasy sip, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct, but sort of almost sort of begrudgingly, because at the moment they're very dependable businesses. They, you know, their key strength is that they have lots of well-known consumer brands that people put in their supermarket trolleys or order over the internet week in, week out. And that's a good thing, and it has been a good thing for a long time. I'm a massive fan of private label products, and I keep a close eye on, you know, on the trends in private label, particularly here in America. And private label is not, you know, for some time now has not been, it's not been the sort of inferior alternative that, you know, you put it in your trolley and it just doesn't do as good a job. And you have the rise of sort of premium owned label now, and it's just getting better and better. And if you look at a lot of the products that Unilever and Reckitt sell, you can substitute those with very, very good private label alternatives for a lot lower price.
Yeah, so if you look in Unilever's case, one of the best performing brands in the Q3 period was Domestos, so it's bleach. Now, I don't care what brand of bleach I put down the toilet. So, but obviously, you know, they have good relationships with supermarkets. They can get those products up front. They can offer, you know, excellent sort of deals, come to arrange with them. So they do have some leverage there to make sure, you know, to encourage people to keep buying the brands over the own label.
Definitely, you know, they've got huge marketing, as you say, they've got huge marketing budgets. They've got a lot of clout with supermarkets in terms of pricing and particularly shelf space, where they actually end up on the supermarket shelf. I think what's very, very clear, even though I hold this sort of long-term sort of secular view on private label, what we've seen quite clearly this year is that consumers have flocked en masse to these brands that have built up a lot of trust over decades. And the strength of the brands at Reckitt's, to a lesser extent Unilever, are really, really shining through. And I think now the key test for both these companies now is to actually exploit what's going on now and make sure that they hold on to new markets, new customers, when everything gets back to normal again. And I'm probably more upbeat on Reckitt's ability to do that than I am on Unilever. Because I think if you look into what's going on with Reckitt, there seems to be more... I think the new chief executive that's come into Reckitt is actually doing some good things. And I think there are signs that looking underneath the bonnet and away from this temporary boost of sales, that there are some quite good things beginning to happen with Reckitt. And leads me to be a bit more optimistic on it and view it in a more favourable light than perhaps I would have done last week even.
Yeah, well, I mean, what sort of things are they doing? I think you're talking the Alpha Report, you know, they're streamlining the business, they're taking cost out. Is there more to it than that?
Yeah, I just take it very positive. Things like, you know, the fact that Dettol and Lysol, they've sold those into 19 new markets this year. Now, they've had their following wind from this, but that shows that there's some agility here and that there's some quick thinking and ability to actually exploit trends.
Yeah.
But I think what's interesting is that I think Reckitt's has realised that it's probably had a pricing problem. You know, we talked a few minutes ago, but, you know, the differential in price between private label and branded products, and then you've got the quality gap is definitely closing between the two. And I think the new guy that's come into Reckitt's has realised that, you know, you have to grow this business sustainably, you have to do it through volume rather than price. And you just basically need to sell more stuff. But to sell more stuff, you need to cut your prices. And you're not seeing price cuts at the moment. You're seeing it's difficult with price because there's a mix effect in there as well. So people can buy higher or better products at higher price. So it's difficult to see what's happening. But there is a clear strategy at Reckitt to take £2 billion of cost out of the business and reinvest it into lower prices. So you take, you know, 300 basis points off your gross margin and hopefully you make it back and more by reinvesting it in price cuts and marketing, and you get the volume through. And Reckitt's is ahead of schedule at doing this. I thought it was really interesting as well that even the infant formula business, which was a terrible acquisition about three or so years ago, even that's seeing sales growth pick up. And that's been an absolute dog.
Yeah.
So I think there are some good signs here that there's a repositioning of the business that's making it more competitive, which suggests that when we normalize, you know, whenever we come out of this situation, this business is in better shape, and perhaps this is a story that investors can warm to over the next few years. And, you know, the ratings of these businesses, and they're not, you know, they are seen as sort of mature, maybe even considered almost ex-growth by some people. But, you know, they're on just over 20 times forecast earnings, which in this market is positively cheap.
Mm. Let's talk about Unilever quickly. Are we seeing sort of similar initiatives at Unilever? I mean, they've had a bit of a tailwind in their sort of cleaning products business. As I said, Domestos, and I think Lifebuoy soap was the other one that they reported as doing very well. But they don't seem to have the sort of strength in depth, as it were, across their brand portfolio. I mean, we actually interviewed Nick Train this week, he loves Unilever, and he loves Unilever because he talks about the power of its brands. But actually, if you sort of dig deep into Unilever, a lot of those brands aren't really working very well at the moment. The sales strength isn't there.
I agree. And you know, I mean, you just compare the sales growth between Unilever and Reckitt's for the you know, third quarter, exactly the same period of time. They've both got December year ends. And Unilever's underlying sales growth was 4% and a bit, and Reckitt's was double digits. Unilever, my main worry about Unilever is that since Warren Buffett and his friends tried to buy it, I think back in 2017, the business has almost been run as if it was actually in the hands of a private equity outfit. So there's been a lot of emphasis on cutting costs and generating cash, and less emphasis on things like product innovation and growing the top line. And you know, you look at like Procter and Gamble. You know, Procter and Gamble is, you know, in a similar sort of position, and you know they have over the last few years tried to develop, you know, new innovative products. And Unilever's, you know, dabbled with this, but largely through things like acquisition. You know, it bought things like Dollar Shave Club. You remember that?
Mm. Yeah, it's quite a big deal.
We never hear it mentioned. I think it paid £1 billion or $1 billion for this business because it was seen as a disruptive, innovative selling model. And we've heard nothing from it. And actually, if you look at that shaving market, it's probably not all it's cracked up to be, because Gillette and Wilkinson Sword have cut their prices. And in fact, Wilkinson Sword has actually bought out Harry's razors. So if you're buying a Harry's razor thinking that you are getting an independent product, you're not. It's owned by Wilkinson Sword. But going back to Unilever, the real issue with Unilever is sales growth and volume growth in particular. And obviously there is some volume growth at the moment from the benefits of the coronavirus and people buying hygiene products. But elsewhere, things aren't great. You know, things like the laundry business, the beauty business, you know, skincare is doing quite well, but things like hair care and other stuff is pretty lackluster. Now, maybe that's because people are staying at home more and not buying as many of these products. But this is actually a long-term issue. Where I think there is some encouragement is that the company referred to a couple of products. So it launched an antibacterial version of Dove, which has been a very successful brand for it, which is obviously quite opportunistic in the current environment. But also things like Hellmann's mayonnaise, they launched a vegan product. And, you know, vegan products are massive. You know, you have to go and walk around any supermarket and you can just see the amount of shelf space, the increasing amount of shelf space that's going towards us. So there is a bit of innovation tapping into to trends, and that, I think that's a good thing. But I think there's a lot more to do with this business.
That's interesting, that vegan mayonnaise point, because I remember, they tried to sue, or they tried to stop an independent rival calling their product vegan mayonnaise, claiming that it wasn't mayonnaise because it didn't have eggs in it. So I hope they're not calling their Hellmann's vegan version mayonnaise, because that would be rather hypocritical looking back. However, Unilever, you know, as I say, championed by Nick Train on the basis of these great brands, a company that you could hold on to forever. I mean, there is, as you said earlier, a reliability about this. Even if you've got some softness here and softness there, isn't this exactly the kind of company that people should be hanging on to during uncertain times like this? It's not going away.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair comment. I think you sleep quite well at night owning Unilever shares. I think the issue is now, I mean, the shares have gone up a lot, you know, over the last, you know, since the bid came, since the management responded, been a big improvement in profits, cash generation. Where does it go from here? And this is where I think it needs to really sort of ramp up the top line. And I'm not of the view, I think Nick Train, you know, his view is that these kind of shares are seriously undervalued because they are bond proxies, basically. They're as reliable as bonds, but with growth on top. And therefore, you have slow but sort of steady growth, but very little risk. And I think his view is that, you know, this should be a company that trades on 40, 45 times earnings rather than 21. Maybe. It's a view. Obviously, that's his view. I think there probably is. You know, there probably is a little bit of merit in that view, but I wouldn't go that far, because I think that to say that Unilever is risk free is like saying that its competitive positioning is so robust that no one could come along and eat its lunch. And I think if you just look at what's going on in the world of food products, beauty products, you see a lot of niche. You know, we talked about private label a lot, but you also see a lot of niche boutique artisan type brands that can enter in local markets, be very nimble, and actually inflict a lot of damage on the big companies. And what tends to happen is the big companies buy them.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Harry's razors. Yeah, absolutely. Just take them out. So they do have that sort of moat, as it were, as well. They are just big enough to gobble up anyone who comes and perhaps threatens them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not, you know, it's a good business. It's a good business. The question is whether it's a great business. And I'm not convinced it is. I think it's, you know, if I own Unilever stock as part of a portfolio, it's fine. You know, I think it will do a job for you. I think it is a lower risk business than lots of other things, but that comes at the expense of growth. And I think if we get back to the real basics and the fundamentals of what makes shareholders money over the long run, it is profits growth.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you can have a repricing of risk and of these so-called quote bond proxies. And let's face it, this is what's driven, you know, the market in big cap for the last decade. You know, you've had these big companies. You know, everybody says, you know, Jim Slater famously quoted as saying that elephants don't gallop. And he's right, you know, they don't. But what's happened is you've had a repricing of these big cap shares, reflecting their perceived riskiness, which is quite low. So the risk is low. And the argument is that you can pay a higher valuation. You can accept a lower rate of return, a lower interest rate, or a higher PE multiple, if you want to look at it that way.
Yeah, you could have said the same about Diageo, though. And in fact, Diageo was, you know, when I looked at this, in fact, it was probably about some 6 or 7 years ago when this sort of bond proxy discussion was sort of really starting to pick up. Diageo was in that basket as well. You'd have Unilever and Diageo and Reckitt. These are reliable companies with amazing brands. And actually, Nick Train has just added a position in Diageo as well. But Diageo proves, you know, what's happened this year, that, you know, there is no such thing as certainty, even when it comes to very large elephants like Diageo.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, as investors, this is an immensely valuable time for investors. Because I've always held the view that you find out more about companies when things are bad than when things are good. When things are good, you know, it can mask things that, you know, are vulnerable about a business. And I think we've had an extreme event this year, which has, you know, drawn back the curtains on a lot of business and let in the light, and people can see how these businesses work, how they fare when times are rough. And I think we've learned a tremendous amount about the resilience or otherwise of many, many businesses this year. And, you know, just as we did in the Great Recession in 2008, 2009, and, you know, it's no surprise that a lot of the shares that have done well over the last decade were the businesses were related to the businesses that were very resilient in a recession. And we've had another weeding out process here. So you come back to a business like Diageo. Diageo for me is, you know, has shown some vulnerability. It's a great business. It's a great business with some great brands, and I think it probably will do pretty well over, you know, over the next 10 years. I think people will be drinking more Tanqueray 10 and Johnny Walker Black Label in 10 years' time than they are now. But the business has been exposed. You know, if bars shut, if people don't travel through duty-free shops in airports, this business takes a hit. You know, and you know, this is a business that, you know, behind the scenes of all the bottles that you see on the supermarket shelves or in bars, you know, there's huge amounts of investment that goes into these businesses. But, you know, you have to lay aside premium scotch for over a decade. You know, that needs financing. And that's a great barrier to entry to competition, but it's also a heavy cost that you need to make a return on. So, I'd be quite happy owning shares of Diageo, but again, you know, it's what price do you put on their cash flows and their profits? To me, you don't put it on the same yield as a bond, because there is, you know, we took this thing that's discussed in academia, you know, the equity risk premium. Equities are risky because businesses move up and down. And as a shareholder, the reason why equities are risky is because you get paid last.
Yeah, and sentiment can simply turn. You know, people can actually decide that actually we don't want these bond proxies anymore. Actually, we value something else more highly, and you may, you know, or there may just be an underlying business problem that takes the share price down, and then you've lost capital.
Yeah, and I think again, you come back to it. You know, what is the medium term growth of a business like Diageo? I don't know, 4-5% top line. And that's all right. You know, if it can deliver that year in, year out, that's fine. This year it won't do that. But yes, you can see that as a steady compounder. But if you can buy a business that's growing a lot more than that, and this is obviously what we're all looking for, you can do a lot better than owning Diageo.
That's true. Should we talk about one of those such businesses? Games Workshop.
Yeah.
Now, you know, this has been, the shares have been motoring, the business has been motoring, reflecting, I'll do that again. The business has been motoring, the shares have been motoring, reflecting that profit growth that's been happening here. I mean, this you say, you know, COVID has highlighted the weakness in some companies. In Games Workshop's case, it's really highlighted the strengths. I mean, it's proven an amazing company, and one that's perhaps sort of caught us out a little bit.
Yeah, I always think that, you know, I'm quite a newcomer to looking at Games Workshop in any kind of detail, and I don't know. You were an analyst, weren't you, once upon a time, John?
I was indeed. Software,
as was I, and I don't know whether you agree with this or not, but you know, I followed companies for years. You know, and it was my, you know, my day job, day in, day out, for 12, 13 years. And I always found that the more you looked at a company, you could always learn something about it. And I've gone back and look at Games Workshop, and I've spent quite a lot of time sort of digging into it a bit more, looking behind the scenes and, you know, doing things like, you know, even going on to sort of internet forums of gamers in the UK and the US. And I spent a lot of time also looking at their Warhammer community site as well. And there's a lot of information that you can glean from this. And you can only walk away from it feeling very, very impressed with how this business is being run. And you know, you've seen a step change in the performance of this business over the last 4 years. And I think what I am even more convinced of now than I was is how this is a much different business under the current chief executive than it was under the previous one. The way that this company is being managed, and I'm talking about here particularly the attitude towards customers. And you know, you rewind, you know, 5-6 years ago, and a lot of gamers, Games Workshop customers who were seriously fed up with how Games Workshop treated them, particularly on things like price hikes, messing around with the rules of the games, the quality of the product, and so on. And, you know, since 2016, this business has been transformed, not only in terms of basically how it engages with its customers.
You talk about pricing in your magazine column. I think this is quite interesting what you're doing here. You mentioned pricing in the context of, fast-moving consumer goods, but pricing's really important here as well. Tell us what Games Workshop are doing that's actually, you know, working really well to sort of engage their customers, and certainly not to annoy them in the way that they perhaps had previously.
Yeah, I mean, they took the decision a few years back just to sort of simplify their pricing and make sure that the price hikes were predominantly coming through on new releases rather than existing products. And, you know, you can dig into the accounts a little. They do actually tell you, you know, the percentage split every year between new and existing products. And, you know, you can just have a look at what's been going on. Obviously, new products today become existing products, you know, next year or whenever they turn to classify that. And you can see that it's having a really positive effect. You know, not only are you getting decent amount of new product launches every year, but if you actually look at what's happening to the existing product base, so they're building up the base and it's growing really nicely. And, you know, just doing something simple as that and painting a picture and putting it into a chart tells you a lot. And, you know, this is something that, you know, the sort of day-to-day business of it is they're selling more stuff. And that is telling you that they are keeping hold of customers. And I think, you know, there's some myths about this company in that, you know, even the company itself sort of 6-7 years ago would have said, you know, we sell equivalent of toy soldiers to teenage boys, and it's become much more than that now. And it's also a global business. You know, this is not, you know, a UK, you know, you see the shops, little shops on the high street or in back streets of towns. This is not just a UK business. 75% of the sales of this business are from outside the UK. And, you know, particularly the American market, and also, you know, to an extent, the Chinese market as well, eventually. There's just huge amounts to go for here. And, you know, you look at a business, I think, I held this view probably until about last week, that this was a business that potentially is very volatile, maybe even faddy, and quite difficult to predict. I don't actually think it. I think it is still quite difficult to predict, but I don't think it's a fad. I think that, I mean, fad's a bit strong. I never thought it was a fad. I just thought that it may move in and out of fashion. But I don't think this is true. I think you know, clearly, you know, there are some very good private investors out in Games Workshop who I've studied this company a lot more than I have and know this business really well. And I think they have come to the conclusion long time before I have. But I'm just very impressed with what's going on here. And I think that if you just look at the pipeline of business, you look at the momentum in this business and the way this business is organised. You know, this is a business which has quite a lot of fixed overhead, which gives it what's known as operational leverage so that its profits can increase faster than its revenue growth. Obviously, that can work in reverse. But I think what I'm getting the feel of here is that there are what's been put in motion over the last 4 or 5 years has made this business a lot more resilient than perhaps people would have thought it might be.
Mm. You do have to pay. You do have to pay up for the shares, though, so they're not cheap. You know, this is a great business, but you have to pay for that again.
You do, but it's not really that much different to the price that you're being asked to pay for other businesses. And, you know, some businesses that are arguably don't have the growth potential that this company has. And I think, you know, one of the things that I looked at in the, you know, in my piece was the just looking at the current forecasts out there. And this is really sort of interesting bit of stock market psychology going on here. Now, I don't know whether this used to be the case. You know, I've not been a city analyst for nearly 14 years, but you always used to know there was a bit of gamesmanship used to go on. But if you had a company that was in a sweet spot, it would always leave what I used to term a bottom drawer, so that, you know, it had forecasts out in the market that it knew that it could beat and potentially smash. And Games Workshop came out with that stunning trading update about 6 weeks ago. And I think everybody was shocked in a good way on that. And I think there is an element of truth. You know, we live in strange times, and the management are probably, are being perfectly upfront, saying, look, we're not sure what's going to happen here. And I think none of us are sure what's happening here, but I think what is happening here is actually quite good. Mm. So we're unsure of it, but we don't know how, but it's a question of, we're not unsure that it could be really bad. It's a question of, we're not sure about how good it could be.
The question is, though, Phil, are you going to buy it back for the fantasy sip, having mistakenly,
maybe,
as you admit yourself, sold it a little bit too early?
Yeah, hands up on this. I should have done with this what I did with Avon, what I've done with Avon Rubber. In that Avon Rubber has become, you know, more expensive than Games Workshop, actually. That's not true, but not far off. Similar values. Probably better earnings visibility. But, you know, you just, one of the lessons you learn is that, and this is just bad habits from when I started investing. I used to be a very far, far too focused on valuation. And I think the rule is, if you have a good business, and let's face it, there are not many outstanding businesses that you can buy on the UK stock exchange, just hang on to it. Hang on to it. You know, we live in a world of low interest rates. And as I say, you know, people are having to reappraise what the definition of fair and reasonable value is. Now, some value investors who are listening to this are probably screaming at their computer screens or their smartphones and thinking, you know, this is just a cop-out to shares that have become overvalued. And I've got some sympathy with that kind of view, but I think this is a really good business. I think the forecasts are too low, and I think the long-term momentum in this business is extremely good. The other thing that I did talk about in this piece was the issue of royalties. And royalties, you know, is, you know, where Games Workshop can leverage their, you know, leverage the brand, leverage the Warhammer brand, and, you know, sell licenses to computer game makers, video makers, board game makers, to use the Warhammer brand, and they can get a royalty stream off it. I think there's a lot of potential here, but I'm probably not as bullish as some people are on it, because I think that management quite rightly have identified it as an opportunity, but they don't want to push it so much that people stop buying the figures and the board games and the books and start playing it on somebody else's computer game instead. So my view is that the royalty potential is there, but I think that it will be managed so that it doesn't threaten the core business. And therefore the value of royalties is, I'm not convinced, whilst the royalty stream is virtually a pure profit because there's no cost against it, I'm not convinced how valuable that stream is. I think the core business is a lot more valuable than the royalty stream. Also because the way that the company gets money for royalties, so it tends to get licensed, certainly are pretty fickle and move in and out of fashion. So I don't think you've got as a sustainable and quality growing revenue stream and profit stream in royalties as you have with the underlying business. I personally think the underlying business, the royalties are there. The royalties are no bad thing, don't get me wrong. And they are incredibly useful for, as well as a source of profit upgrade, but maybe not value upgrades, is that they cement the brand, they reinforce the brand. And, you know, this is something that is all powerful with this company. And something that, you know, if you look at, you know, another good gaming company, Frontier Developments, this is something that they've done very well as well. And it's you know, really, you're just going back to basics, aren't you? You know, look after your customer, engage your customer. And Games Workshop, I think that I've certainly underappreciated. I don't know whether the market underappreciates it, but I think that the foundations that have been built with customer engagement here, my gut feeling is that this has got a long way to run.
Yeah. Sounds like another classic example of the power of brands, really. So kind of supporting Nick Train's view, but this is a powerful brand with a lot of growth ahead of it. So perhaps slightly different in that respect. Maybe they'll surprise us on the royalty front as they've surprised us before. Who knows? One to keep an eye on.
I think if you look at the forecast for royalties at the moment out there in the market, there's definitely scope to, you know, do better than that.
Yeah. Sounds like they'll have a card up their sleeve. So thanks, Phil. Been good talking, as always. Don't think you're around next week, are you? I think you're having a well-deserved break. So speak to you in a couple of weeks. Enjoy your holiday.
Yeah, thanks a lot, John. Talk to you soon.
Speak later.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.